Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Davis presiding.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. The first matter before the court this afternoon is the case of the estate of Milton. It's case number 55634. Is counsel ready to proceed? Very well. Mr. Benson, welcome to the other side of the podium.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry, 2 minutes?
Yes, please. And I will be splitting my time as equally as I can with Mr. Kehoe for the other.
Very well. Appellants.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Benson, Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the appellant, the State of Nevada. This court should reverse the district court because the finding by the district court that the 1995 will is a valid will, yet failing to enforce it in disinheritance provisions, that ruling is contrary to Nevada law, which expressly permits wills that do nothing more than limit who can take by intestate succession. The New York cases that this court asked us to address on oral argument support the state's position in this case. In New York in 1967, they amended their definition of a will so that it includes instruments whereby a person disposes of property or directs how it shall not be disposed of. In the estate of Bo case, the court held that that change to the statute effectively abolished the previous common law rule in New York, which was the American rule. In other words, that an heir's property interest in the property of the deceased could not be defeated except by a valid device or bequest to other persons. That's essentially the American rule. And the court held there that the new definition of the term will abolished that rule. The change in the statute meant that the device to the daughter of only $5 in the will precluded her also from taking any property that descended by intestate succession. The New York court in the Stoffel case followed this rule again. It reasoned that the previous common law rules, and I quote, are wrong in principle in that they defeat the manifest intention of the decedent, that certain of his blood relatives shall not receive any of his property. Any person should have the absolute and unqualified right so to provide in his will, and his direction to that effect should be recognized and given effect by law. That same reasoning is equally applicable here, and Nevada's law is actually more precise than New York's law because it explicitly says that a will includes an instrument that merely excludes a person or a class from taking by intestate succession. This is consistent with the legislative history in this case for the 1999 amendments to the probate code, which stated that they were intended to eliminate the unnecessary technicalities that defeat the intention of a person making a will. So in this case, a will that...
So you just stated that and just... His intention was to pass it to a specified person. That could not be effectuated. And now we have this escheat to the state. We have specific language in 134, if the decedent leaves no surviving spouse or kindred, the estate escheats to the state for educational purposes. But he's left family. And I understand he stated what he stated, but we have some difficulties with that. We're indicating that this holographic will is valid, but yet or has effect as to the first will. Don't we have some difficulties with public policy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because as this court has held prior, the primary purpose of the probate code is to effectuate the intent of the testator. Here, he did intend to give it to his girlfriend, Susie Kelleher. He also clearly intended that Larry Melton, Vicki Palm, and all the rest of his relatives were not to receive 1 cent of his estate. That we know for certain. That appears within the four corners of the document, and it's very clear. It's underlined, it's bold in the original of the will.
But then we have the state saying that making a will not become effective if you have family and you don't account for them in another statute.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, we have other provisions in the statute that dictate some other things in terms of the validity of wills and it's cheating to the state and so on. How do we reconcile that or don't we reconcile that?
I think that the legislature has already reconciled that for us. They set out a succession scheme wherein the state is defined as an heir. It is listed as the last heir in the succession statutes. Unlike the South Dakota case, our sheet statute provides for sheet even when there are heirs, but they are not capable of taking. Furthermore, they enacted this statute that specifically allows somebody to exclude who can take by intestate succession. So I think they have already made that public policy decision. The normal and natural, logical, and legal result of disinheriting all your relatives is that it escheats to the state.
Mr. Benson, let me ask you a question. There was some substantial amendment to what we might refer to as our probate code in the last session, specifically SB 221. Is there anything in that in those amendments that affects our argument here today?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, and I admit that I am not fully aware of what those amendments were in that particular bill, but my understanding is that the probate code that exists at the presently at the time that this case came before the district court is what is controlling in this case.
I understand that it would not be applicable to the facts of this case. My question is whether or not we, in your opinion, need to be mindful of substantial changes that may have been made that might affect subsequent cases. But I think you've answered it, frankly, by saying that you don't think that it applies. I have another question. Do you debate in any way that the 1995 letter essentially revokes, at least by implication, the 1975 will?
It revokes the 1975 will because the 1995 will is itself a valid will. And any valid will necessarily revokes all prior valid wills.
And you base that upon our statutory scheme that says that since the holographic letter of 1995 meets all the terms and conditions set forth in the statute to make it a will, it is in fact a will as valid as any other properly executed document.
That is correct, and it also says exactly that in the statute pertaining to holographic wills, that such wills have the same effect of any will that's formally executed.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. I see I've run out of my time, so I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Colleagues?
Thank you.
Mr. Kehoe, before you begin, I failed to make an important announcement before we began these arguments. You may notice that Justice Hardesty is not with us, and due to an emergency situation, he is not able to be with us here in person, but he will definitely participate in the disposition of these cases. He will hear these arguments as if he were here. He will simply hear them by audio.
Okay. Your Honors, I'm sorry. I have a hard time hearing. I thought it would be okay because I don't normally hear, but I just wanted to mention, I hope that I can hear everything that's being said, but I apologize for it. I thought that I'd be able to hear more easily, but I think I've heard okay up to this point. I just wanted to mention that it is difficult if we don't speak up.
Counsel, if you're having any problem whatsoever hearing us or anyone else, please let me know, and we'll make sure to give appropriate accommodations.
Thank you.
Mr. Keough.
Thank you. My name is Ty Kehoe. I represent two half-sisters, Linda Orte and Sherry Briner. May it please the court. Our position is similar to the state, only in the sense that we believe the district court decision should be reversed. We believe that the 1975 will is the proper will to be effectuated here, and that is based on a variety of legal reasonings, including the questionability of the 1995 letter, the definition of a revocation of a will in 133.130, and the doctrine of dependent relative revocation.
But counsel, the state has in essence asserted that they think the 95 will is the secondary will is valid, and you're taking the opposite position. I understand why, but
I am in fact. The 1995 will, however, even if it is presumed valid by this court, I still believe that the doctrine of dependent relative revocation will resurrect the first will.
Well, this state has not adopted that, to my knowledge. Why should we consider that?
I am a completely separate party from the state. Although we're both appellants, we have completely divergent.
I understand that.
Okay. I agree. The state has not. But under the doctrine, it is a facts and circumstances analysis, and the intent being to apply the intent of the testator. to determine the intent of the testator and apply that to the facts of this situation. And in this situation, his letter was clearly just a letter. The respondent puts very well why it was just a letter in his district court pleadings, which is cited in my opening brief. And
counsel, what tenet of the statute does that document not meet? You're classifying it as a letter, but what does it not comport with out of the statute?
And for purposes of this argument, Your Honor, Justice Douglas, I would concede we could consider it a will. I think there are arguments that it's not, but I think our stronger arguments are that it's a will. But it became, as you referenced, ineffective. That's, in fact, the precise word that is used by the district court in its decision, and it's the precise word that is ruled in the case or used in the cases cited by myself.
Ineffective because the Ms. Kelleher predeceased Mr. Melton?
Correct. And upon that ineffectiveness, I think you have two options. You can either escheat it to the state, or you can deem it a non-will, and you can decide whether or not to apply the first will. I think the first will should be applied. I think that is the purpose or the intent of the testator. 133.130 specifically requires a destruction, cancellation, or revocation of a will for that statute to be applied. It doesn't cite an ineffectiveness or a will that becomes invalid for any reason. And that's what the cases focus on, is a will that becomes invalid for any reason. Here we have a will that has become invalid. The question is,
well, wait a minute. 133.130 says the destruction, cancellation, or revocation of the second will does not revive the first will.
Correct. And in this case, the second will is the 1995 letter, and it was neither canceled, destroyed, or revoked.
So why doesn't your argument then validate the state's position? Because that will also had a dispossession or disinheriting clause in it.
It absolutely does, Justice Pickering, and that's an option. And if you decide that the global disinheritance provision is applicable in this state and that a will can merely disinherit everybody in the world, then that's the end result.
But isn't that the overarching policy of our entire probate code, is that the testator should be the person to speak to the disposition of his or her assets?
And I believe it is. And I think that the question then becomes, do you permit the global disinheritance, or in this situation where you have a classic reason to apply the doctrine of dependent revocation, relative revocation, do you go back to the first will? He kept that will in a safety deposit box. He secured it. It's quite possible that he believed his letter became invalid when his girlfriend died, and he kept his formal will in his safety deposit box for years.
It is equally as possible that he intended, should Susie predecease him, that the state get all that money.
There's no indication that he wanted anything to go to the state.
Well, there's a great indication that he wanted nothing to go to his children.
To his daughter.
Right.
There's little indication that he wanted nothing to go to my clients. The first will does not disinherit my clients. The first will only disinherits his daughter. And so if we're looking at his global intent, and if you presume he didn't want it to go to the state, then I believe what's most clear here is that it should not go to the daughter, that the first will should be revived, and that would necessitate a remand by this court to the district court because that first will has not been analyzed or considered at all.
Before, where do you get from the terms of the second or 1995 letter an intention to have the earlier will revived in the event Susie predeceases the testator?
There's no indication of that in the letter itself.
Where is, so you're just reasoning from the fact that he gave money to his girlfriend, and if she died, it stands to reason he would have wanted it to go back to the first?
Correct. It stands to reason that he wouldn't want it to go to the state of Nevada. He would prefer the first will over that. And it stands to reason he wouldn't want it to go to his daughter, who has been twice disinherited. Those seem to be the only two options.
But under, I was trying to make 133-130 fit this as we were getting ready for your piece of this argument. It says, unless it appears by the terms of the revocation that it was the intention to revive and give effect to the first will. So for you to prevail here, you have to establish, first of all, that the second will was canceled by the death of Susie, but then secondly, that intended to revive the first one. There has to be some evidence of that other than just in the air, wouldn't you say, under the statute?
Well, I think the evidence is the safety deposit box, the securing of the formal will, the non-securing of the letter for years and years. His girlfriend was a co-account holder on the safety deposit box. She had the ability to destroy the original
will. That's not by the terms of the revocation itself, which is...
But there was no revocation.
Okay.
And that's where I think the doctrine of dependent relative revocation becomes relevant, is when something happens that the testator didn't anticipate or didn't contemplate. If he had purposefully revoked the will, then I think it's a different result.
But counsel, you're misstating the holding in Shepard, where Nevada talks about by mistake, fraud, and the like. You're injecting your advocacy, which I appreciate, for your client in terms of what little stated law we have on this subject. Because my initial question was talking about dependent relative revocation, and I asked you a question about it, and you just kind of bounced over it, but that's one of the fundamental issues us. How do we apply that doctrine? Not the restatement third, which is a broader doctrine, but the limited doctrine, or should we be moving into the restatement third?
And I think that every case that I have read on the doctrine is wide and varied.
Well,
but what
let's talk about Nevada. Not every case you've read, but Nevada.
I could not find any decision in the state of Nevada that applies the doctrine of dependent relative revocation. Kruppenberg evidences that it exists here, that it is applicable here.
By virtue of statute,
right.
133-130.
We have a limited case council of 77 Nevada at 233, which is a matter of this, in the Shepard case, which I talked about, which was cited in our materials.
Did you wish? I know we were badgering you at the end, and I do apologize for that. Let me make my comment more in the form of a question. Would you agree with me, although our case law has not, with clarity, embraced the doctrine of relative revocation, but in fact the statutes give life to it for our consideration?
I don't think the statute addresses it at all, quite frankly. I think that the doctrine is more of a common law type doctrine, and it's a doctrine that's widely applied across the country, and it's a doctrine that was referenced in Kruppenberg as not applying in that case, which in my opinion indicates that it could apply in the correct case, and I think this is a perfect case for it to be applied.
Thank you. Mr. Kehoe.
Thank you.
I have one more question while you're right there. You just indicated to me that he didn't specifically indicate your clients as his intention to disinherit them. But I'm looking at the 95 letter, and it specifically mentions Vicki Palm, and it also mentions any other relative. He did not want any other relative to have one penny underlined. Are your clients not a relative?
They are, in fact, Your Honor, and I believe everybody on the earth would be a relative to some degree. But the difference that I believe exists is similar to a will that has a global disinheritance clause at the end of the will. I, therefore, disinherit anybody else that isn't provided for in this will. And this court has held that in anti-lapse statutes, that global disinheritance does not disinherit children of relatives under the anti-lap statute. And so I think that it is a lesser disinheritance. I think it's a lesser standard.
So it's a lesser disinheritance than the disinheritance to Vicki Paul?
I believe it is, particularly since she was disinherited in the first will also.
Okay.
Sada, may I ask one more question?
Of course, of course.
I have one more question for you. So to be clear here, you are not arguing that 133-130 controls. You're rather arguing that the common law doctrine of dependent relative revocation controls here?
That's correct.
And you would agree that under 133-130, your clients cannot succeed? Or do you go that far?
I don't go that far because I think it's inapplicable, because the will failed on its face. It became ineffective, as the district court held, as opposed to being purposefully canceled or revoked or destroyed by the testator. And I think that's just one of the many facts and circumstances that are considered by the courts in applying the doctrine.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And Mr. Benson, so that you don't worry, I'm going to give you the 2 minutes that you reserved. We peppered the appellants with questions, and I'll give you those 2 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel.
I'm Whitney Warnick, and I represent the respondents in this case, Your Honors. I think there's a couple of facts that need to be cleared up. There's been some conclusion that the 1975 will disinherited the decedent's daughter. If you read the languages in that will, that's by far not a clear statement. But in the 1975 will. But in the 1995 will, yes, there is a disinheritance clause for both the daughter, the brother, and for all of the relatives. Why did the decedent put those clauses in that will? Read the 1995 will carefully. First of all, he says, I want my entire estate, and he underlines the word entire, to go to my beloved Mrs. Kelleher. He had been with her 25 years. That's what he wanted. Then he says, I don't want anything to go to my relatives or my family. Clearly, what he's trying to do here is prevent the application of forced heir statutes in Nevada. If you look at the format of Nevada law under Chapter 133, a person is entitled to make out a will disposing of his estate. That's the only right he's given. But in 133, he's warned that if you intend to not leave your estate to any of your close relatives, you better put a provision in there saying why. Otherwise, the forced heir statutes could trump your will, and your will not go to the person you want it to go to. And that's exactly what this decedent did, both in his 1975 will and he did it in his 1995 will. He put those provisions in there to assure the distribution he wanted under his will. Once Mrs. Kelleher died, we don't have any idea what his intentions are. We do have some idea, though, that he still favored his family, because all of his wills, all of his codicils from the 1975 up through the 1995, all favored his family, except for the 95, when he wanted to give everything to the love of his life.
How about the language in that 1995 letter that speaks to any relative?
I agree.
But Doesn't that include...
He put that language in there because he didn't want anyone to make a claim to his estate that would contradict and invalidate the property he wanted to leave to his beloved Mrs. Kelleher. If he had any animosity towards his family, we have no evidence of that. We do have evidence that he felt close to his family. He made them the heirs of his will in 1975, and they existed as heirs of his will until 1995. He put the provision in the 1995 will because he had some sophistication as a will maker, both in 1975 and 1995, that he had to put some provision in there to prevent the application of forced heir statutes. But I'd like to get to the Nevada law. I would submit that prior to 1999, with the laws as they are in the state of Nevada, no one would argue that the American rule would not be applicable in this case. And so the legislature adopts some definition sections. And if you read the legislative minutes, that's all they intended to do with the definition sections. There's nothing in there that says they intended to change the framework of Nevada law. As a matter of fact, it says they intended not to change the framework of Nevada law. If they were intending to adopt the disinheritance provisions from the Uniform Probate Code, which is the argument of the state, they would have followed the Uniform Probate Code model. They would have put the substantive sections in there that did exactly that. Instead, all they did is adopt some embellishment language to their will definition. The will definition in the first sentence says, a will is an instrument which leaves a defendant's estate to someone, distributes it to someone. That's the common law definition of a will. And that is the definition of the will in Nevada. It has to distribute the estate to somebody. Then they embellished that language from wording from the Uniform Probate Code. And why did they do that? Well, the Uniform Probate Code is a model code for statutory provisions. States throughout the country use the Uniform Probate Code to assist them in preparing and enacting model provisions. I respectfully submit the legislature had no idea of the situation that's now before this court. I submit that they adopted that language because it's from a respected source. It's also reflected in the laws of the surrounding states. And they adopted that language as embellishment to their will definition section simply because they thought that it correctly reflected what can be in a will. And they were right, because as we know, disinheritance clauses are in wills all the time, and they have to be in wills. A good testator will not omit that, especially if he's omitting leaving any of his estate to close relatives. And so the language is clearly applying to when a will is made. That's what that the definition is. A will can include these phrases, these expressions. It's a testate situation, not an intestate situation. The decedent is not planning on an intestacy when he makes out a will. There's a presumption at law that he's not planning on an intestacy. So the statute says in making out a will, these are the provisions you can put in a will. And this is what a will contains. And a good will should contain a clause, a disinheritance clause, if the decedent doesn't want to run the risk of having his will trumped and having some close relative then take his estate as opposed to the person he wants to give it to.
You mean like your client?
At the time. If you read this, the Jeter decision, it really discusses this in great detail. And the Jeter decision from South Dakota points out just exactly why a decedent puts those clauses in his will. And it references the laws of the state of Oregon and the state of New Jersey, where it says when the clause is like this in his will, after saying to whom he wants his estate to go to, he's putting that clause in there to make sure that his property goes to the person he wants it to go to and that these close relatives don't make a claim that could set it aside. But once the person that he wants the property to go to dies, we don't have any idea what his intent is. Everybody is just speculating in this case as to what Mr. Melton's intent was after Mrs. Kelleher died. But we do have some indication that he did not disfavor his family. He left everything to his family before that. And so what indication do we have that he wouldn't want his estate to go now to his family now that Mrs. Kelleher died? There's less speculation in saying that he would want that and that the intestate succession law should be applied. Now, if the court determined that that definition section has overridden and made the American rule inapplicable, which I really respectfully submit the legislature didn't intend to do, but if the court determines that that is the case, then we have a situation where Mr. Melton's will disinherits all of the family that he has, but it doesn't give his estate to anybody. He has done nothing under his will. No one can reasonably say that he intended his estate to go to the state of Nevada. As the state Supreme Court in the case of Jeter said, that would be a bizarre intent indeed to try to ascribe to any decedent, any testator. And so we have a situation like they described in Jeter where he has done nothing. His will is totally ineffective. If he had only disinherited one or two relatives, then it would be presumed that he wanted to give what they would have received under a disinheritance situation to the other heirs that survived. But he disinherits everybody. And so we have the situation that exists in the Jeter case, which is the only case in the United States that has facts exactly on point with the facts in this case and in which the court faced some of the similar legal issues. And even in Jeter, they had the substantive provisions for the Uniform Probate Code, which would have allowed a better argument for an escheat to the state. But the Jeter court noted that if you're not going to do anything in your will, if you're not going to give your property to anybody, and you're not going to let anybody else take it, then you're through. You know, we want to respect the decedent's intention. We want to try to effectuate that. But there comes a point where a decedent hasn't made out a will. And then we turn to the intestate succession laws, which are passed by the legislature of the state of Nevada. Is Chapter 134 any less powerful, any less mandatory than the definition of the section of a will? Chapter 134 says if a decedent dies intestate, you must distribute his estate pursuant to the provisions of that chapter, the priorities set forth for inheritance in that chapter. There is no law in Nevada that says if a decedent in his will puts a disinheritance clause in his will, But that means under intestate succession, the person disinherited can inherit. We have no law that says that. We have no law that says the state of Nevada can inherit by a sheet the decedent's estate. If the decedent leaves kindred, there's no law that says we can presume that the kindred don't exist because there's a disinheritance clause in the will. What the state's position is asking the court to do is to engage in judicial legislation, to pretend that there are some statutes that say, well, if you disinherit somebody, that means that they're dead and they can't inherit under the intestate succession laws. And that means that the state then can take, because we're going to presume that these people are dead. But there's no law in Nevada that says that.
It's a matter of interpreting the statutes. I disagree with your statement.
I can understand that, Your Honor, but why did they put specific provisions in the Uniform Probate Code to cover the situation? You know, the state of New York passed the law because the state legislature there had a history of studying that situation. They had a history of American rule being followed for many years in the state of New York, and they wanted to change that. And they had a legislative commission that studied that and recommended to the legislature that they change the law and they allow the disinheritance clause to be effective in intestate situations. We do not have that situation in Nevada. Plus, the law that they passed says a will can either give the property to somebody or can state to whom it's not to go to. We don't have that in Nevada. And it, you know, if you're going to interpret legislation, you try to do it harmoniously with all the rest of the legislation. How do you interpret the second sentence of NRS 132.370 without also recognizing the first sentence? The first sentence says that that will must distribute the decedent's property. The legislature then turn around in the second sentence and say, well, that's not really necessary. He can just put in a will who he doesn't want it to go to, and then you guess to who the property should be distributed.
But at the time he wrote the 1995 will, it did distribute his property, and it did include certain people, including his daughter and his heirs. On the death of Ms. Kelleher, that changes in your argument. But why does that disqualify it from statutorily remaining as a will? It was a will when it was executed, you agree, right?
It was a will. The district court held that it was a will, and it was admitted as a will. But it became effective from the standpoint of distributing his estate, because he didn't have anybody left that he named who could take the estate, and he disinherited everyone else. So we could say it was a will, and I even said that in my brief. I said, you know, if there was an appointment of an executor under that situation, it could have still applied. But he has made no direction, has given no direction on where his estate to go to. So now he leaves it to the court. He leaves it to everyone to guess, what do you want to do? That's not a good situation for the court to be in. That's not good legislative procedure.
Do you disagree with the fact that in both of the two documents, the 1975 will and the 1995 will, that we could more faithfully, at least faithful to his wishes, assume that if Ms. Kelleher wasn't alive, that he surely didn't want anybody in his family to have this money? I mean, that certainly seems to be the intent of both of the documents that he executed distributing his estate.
How does it show that in the 75 will? In the 75 will, he gave everything to his family.
Well, except your client.
No, he didn't say my client. If you read the provision of that will, it says, I don't want any children, plural, to take. And then later on he says, I don't want any dependents of my parents to take. And that was only in one half of that will. That will contained two separate wills. And so there's no way that my client was disinherited completely under that will. She may have been the person he was referring to, but all that shows is that the decedent was aware of forced heir statutes and wanted to avoid the application of those forced heir statutes to make sure that the property went to whom he gave it to in his will. I think that's significant, because his intent was not to just disinherit him under any circumstance. His intent was to make sure that they got that the person that he named in his will received what he was leaving to them. We don't have any indication that he had any dislike of his daughter, that he had any animosity towards her, or any other members of his family. As a matter of fact, they were the heirs of his estate planning before the 1995 will.
Except where he says, or any other relative, to have one penny of my estate.
Well, I believe he says that because he doesn't want to take any chances, again, that a forced heir statute could be applied. If you notice, he underlines the word entire. I want my entire estate to go to Mrs. Kelleher.
Then he says, I don't want my relatives to receive one penny. That's a clear indication that he wants it all to go to Mrs. Kelleher, but I don't want anything to go to my other relatives. But that doesn't tell us what he wants to do in the event that she dies. And before that, he had given his relatives everything. So I would presume we have more evidence to indicate he would want his relatives to take than anyone else now that he's died intestate. And I would presume that under the English rule, if you decide that the NRS 132.370 did abrogate the American rule, which I respectfully submit it didn't, and it's not, I respectfully submit that the American rule is the best rule for handling these cases. And that's proven by the United States precedent. It's the majority rule throughout the United States. There's only a few states that have contrary rules. I think it's the best rule because it prevents legislative speculation. It doesn't put the court in a position of having to guess and speculate as to what the decedent meant or what he didn't mean. And it creates predictability. But if the American rule is not going to be applied in this case, then I respectfully submit that the English rule should be applied because the decedent did nothing under his will. He gives us no direction under his will.
But what do you do with the inclusion of the language in 132.370 in the definition of a will that includes expressly excluding or limiting the right of an individual or class to succeed to property? Read on its face, the legislature seems to be including a negative disinheritance as a legitimate piece of a will.
We could jump to that conclusion, Your Honor. And the reason we do is because the language is identical to the Uniform Probate Code language. But it also...
Stick with just the language before you go off to Uniform Probate Code.
The language.
What in that language is ambiguous?
The language can also be interpreted as I have suggested. And that is that it's dealing with forced heir statutes and the right of the decedent to put that clause in there. And in fact, Chapter 133 says he better do that if he's not leaving his estate to families. But more importantly, the interpretation which we're advocating harmonizes that section, and it harmonizes Chapter 134. It doesn't create any contradictions. It doesn't require this court to create fictions or to come up with statutes that don't exist in order to let happen what the state wants to happen.
But it renders the addition of that language into that definitional section sort of nugatory, doesn't it?
It's how you interpret it, Your Honor. I agree it's how you interpret it. But that is dealing with a will. And so if you're dealing with a will and the decedent is making out a will, he's not intending an intestate situation. He wants to have the property go to the person he's giving it to under the will. So it says he can...
No, I understand that point. I'm just trying to understand what we should do with the addition of that language in that statute.
I will agree it's troubling. That's the only reason we're before the court today, is because of that language. But I submit that the legislative intention doesn't support the interpretation of the state. It would cause confusion, disharmony in our statutes to have it that way, and it makes more sense to adopt the respondent's position in that case.
Counsel, before you sit down, how do you deal, though, with NRS 133.130, effect of revocation of subsequent will? The second will revokes the first will, and there's nothing that meets the requirements to bring that first will back.
I agree, 100%. That's our position, Your Honor. That's our position, definitely.
But then we get into the next area, and that is in that second will that we're saying revoke the first will, if we give it any accord, if we give, as you're arguing about his intent, he specifically mentions the daughter and says nothing.
Mentioned his brother, too. Those are probably the only relatives he knew. I mean, you know, that well. But I submit, Your Honor, that he mentioned him because he didn't want to force their statute to apply, and that doesn't solve our question now. Did he want the property to inherit to the state of Nevada? I don't think so.
Well, which brings us to the other, which you've totally discounted it, and we have the statute that things to do is cheat to the state, and those people across the way made a public policy that can happen. What are we to do?
You're talking about 154.010?
Just in general.
That particular chapter is a procedural chapter. Once an escheat is determined by another law, that the state has the right to escheat. And NRS 152.020, it states that when the state claims an escheat, they have to state what law they're premising that on. And then it takes 6 years before the escheat can be completed.
154 is a procedural chapter, but even 154 says you can't have in a sheet if there's heirs. And we clearly have heirs in this case. We have kindred, and they're not incapable of inheriting by any law in the Nevada, on the Nevada books. Just because a decedent can put a disinheritance clause in his will doesn't mean they're not entitled to inherit under the inheritance statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
We do have a clause, though, counsel, that indicates that once he basically says they can't inherit, they're just presumed gone, dead, not existing for purposes of consideration. How do we balance that out?
I think we have to look at all the whole chapter, the whole probate code. We have to make sure it's harmonious and it makes sense. And if we're going to let one definition section that we don't have any idea why the legislature particularly chose that wording, there's nothing in the legislative minutes that tell us, but we know it contradicts the rest of the chapter 134. What's more important, those laws that have been set up and have been on the books for ages that give a person the right to inherit, or are we going to give an interpretation to that section which is contrary to that and which conflicts with that? We can give an interpretation to that section that harmonizes that and makes sense. And that's what I'm submitting we should do in this case. But if you don't want to give that interpretation, then I suggest we should still apply the English rule, because in any sense, he didn't make any disposition of his estate, as I said in the Jeager case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warnick. Mr. Benson.
Could you address his last point that he made
regarding the English rule? Certainly, yes. Your Honor. The English rule is also incompatible with Nevada law, because the theory behind that rule is that a disinheritance of one heir is an implied gift of that heir's share to the remaining heirs. In this case in particular, where you have disinherited all of your relatives, the state being defined as an heir and as the last heir on that list of who is entitled to take by intestate succession is the last heir that's left. And even if you were to theoretically apply the English rule, because the state is an heir, it would come to the state.
But he's indicating as well that there's no statute of law that indicates you are the last heir.
I would respectfully disagree with that. The state is specifically defined as an heir in Chapter 132, and it is also at the bottom of the list in the list of intestate succession, where it states if somebody dies without any kin, then it escheats to the state. And so under those laws, and additionally under 154.110, it states that when somebody, it does not say when somebody has no heirs, it says when there are no heirs capable of inheriting, then it escheats to the state. And that is not just a procedural statute. It does have some procedures in there in terms of the mechanics of how you go to court, but it also provides, I believe it's entitled, when in state escheats.
So an express disinheritance, in your view, makes them incapable.
That is correct. And that is because there is a law that provides for that, and that's the definition of the will, because it expressly allows wills that do nothing more than state who cannot take by intestate succession. And that's exactly what Mr. Melton has done in this case. I think the most appropriate intent to infer here is the obvious intent, that he didn't want any of his relatives to receive one penny of his estate. The same with the legislature. The most apparent intent is that what they said in the statute is what they meant, rather than assume that Mr. Melton was concerned about some kind of forced heir statute, or that the legislature was concerned that the legislature wanted to somehow allow the English rule to operate when it never provided for it in other statutes.
Why can't you infer as to what Mr. Warnick said about if he wanted Kelleher to get it, he wanted his girlfriend to get it, and if she didn't get it, he had no knowledge that it was going to go to the state. It sounds like this guy really didn't understand wills and trusts and probates. Why is his interpretation not right?
Because what we do know is that he did not want his daughter, Vicky Palm, or any of his other relatives to receive one penny of his estate. We don't have to guess at that. We're not speculating. That's clear on the face of the four corners of the document. What Mr. Warnick is speculating is that Mr. Melton would have somehow been completely okay if his daughter got his entire estate through intestate succession as opposed to under his will, or that he would rather his relatives receive it all in the event that Ms. Kelleher predeceased him. That is speculation. What is not speculation is reading the actual will itself, which says that they are not to receive one penny of his estate. That is the best indication of his intent that we have, and I think that that is what we should enforce here. He has never acted inconsistently with that. He kept that will the entire time. He never destroyed it. He never showed any intention to revoke it. Additionally, he made substantial gifts to others outside of his family after Susie's death. There's nothing to indicate that he, in fact, wanted to revoke that will in any way, shape, or form.
And disagree with the position of the half-sisters?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You disagree with the position of the half-sisters?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, because whether you apply the common law rule or the statutory rule of dependent relative revocation, the first element that is necessary there is that the second will somehow be invalid or that it somehow be revoked. That is not the case here. The 1995 will is a valid will that was never revoked, that was never canceled, nor is it invalid. The death of Susie Kelleher did not invalidate an otherwise valid will. All it did is cause the gift to lapse. That is the normal result under Nevada law. Had he not disinherited all of his other relatives, this would be a completely unremarkable case, because that gift would lapse, it would become part of the residuum of the estate, and it would go to whatever heirs were not disinherited. The only reason we're here is because there's the potential for an escheat in this case. And what Mr. Warnick is pressing on this court is to create an exception in the law where none presently exists.
Well, but what he's saying is that a conventional pretermitted heir statement should not be interpreted as a negative will.
That is, my understanding is that that's what he's arguing, and of course that was the traditional common law rule. Here we have a statute that is directly in conflict with the common law rule and is apparently created to abolish that common law rule, just as the New York courts have held in their cases.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Benson. Mr. Kehoe, Mr. Warnick, thank you very much for your time and attention to this matter. This case will stand submitted.